भद्रं कर्णेभिश्नुयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टिवागुंसस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्थधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. Pranavo hyaparam brahma, pranavo hyaparam brahma, pranavascha parasmitaha, pranavascha parasmitaha, apurvo nantaro bahyaha, apurvo nantaro bahyaha, anaparaf pranavo vyayaha, anaparaf pranavo vyayaha, pranavaha ki aparam brahma, pranavaha cha paraha smritaha, apurvaha anantaraha abahyaha anaparaha pranavaha avyayaha. Pranavaha, so the Mandukya, just to refresh a little bit, the Mandukya Upanishad, right? The whole topic of the Mandukya Upanishad is the Omkara, the very sacred syllable Om. Okay? And the Om is the whole, as the Mandukya Upanishad unfolds, this sacred syllable Om is actually the name for Brahman, or the name for all that is. So it's an all-inclusive name of the reality of the universe. And so the Mandukya Upanishad unfolds the nature of the reality of the universe through its name, which is Om. And so this name, Om, called Pranava, we usually don't even talk about the word Om. Like, we don't usually say Omkara or something like that. Unless we're saying Om as part of a chant, you know, or something like that as part of a prayer, we'll say the actual word Om. Otherwise, we'll refer to Om as Pranava. That's the name for the Om. Instead of just bantering it around in, you know, in common parlance, you'll refer to it as Pranava. And so here, in this Mandukya Upanishad, it's unfolding the nature of reality and relating the nature of reality to this sacred syllable Om. And so just to very briefly, I'm just going to kind of give you an overview and we'll take off from there. If we look at the nature of all that is, the first thing we have to do is divide all that is into what is the subject and what is the object. I can divide all of my experience into the subject, me, right, and everything else. And so what the Omkara is doing is looking, is taking the three letters, a, u, m, and using those three letters to indicate the totality of our experience. In this sense, the letter a stands for the waker and the waking world. So right, that's us right now. We're awake, we're in this waking world. So that's the a. The u, because o is made of a plus u, The U stands for the dream state, the dream world. The dreamer in the dream world. So if you say that, they're subject-object. If I say like this, the waker and the waking world, I'm now looking at this waking state of an experience, and when I'm looking at it, I'm including myself in it as the waker. So I'm the waker who is included and contained in the waking world. Also, in the U, I am the dreamer, the dream character, we can look at it, who is in the dream world. And then if I take the Ma, it's the deep sleep state. So the A, U, M, when I say Om, it stands for the waking state, the waker in the waking state, the dreamer in the dream state, and the deep sleep state where everything is in unmanifest condition, which means the waker and the dreamer are in unmanifest condition. There is no duality being experienced in the deep sleep state. And so if you go through your 24-hour day, right, you can divide your experiences in this way: waking state, dream state, deep sleep state. Waking state means any state of experience where you're using your sense organs. Dream state really, in it's the most extreme. The dream state is the most extreme form, but in the, of those types of imaginings, dreams, any type of mental, emotional experience that is not using your sense perception. So, for instance, if you're having a daydream, right, you're not using sense perception at that time. You're in another world. You're in the dream world, in a sense. And so that covers a whole different sphere of perception. And the deep sleep, of course, the way, the subject-object relationship is collapsed. And so if I know that the letter O is the waking state, the U is the dream state, and the makara, the ma, is the deep sleep state, then when I say just om, if I've studied all of this, I say om, what comes to mind is what was the experiences that are available to me in duality. The dual world of subject-object comes to mind when I say om, waker, dream, deep sleep. But there's another thing that needs to be recognized when I say this sacred syllable, om. And that is what is on either side of it. So, for instance, if I say, that's what makes this so complete. If I say om, 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 what is on either side of it is silence, right? That silence is called that which has no letter. The silence has no letter. It's called a mantra. Mantra means letter. It has no letter. The silence also has no beginning, right? And the silence isn't doing anything to become om. So what you recognize when you say you're chanting om or working with this particular teaching methodology is that what you recognize is that actually the om comes from silence. Just this letter, just in our... In using the simple sounds, the comes from silence, the om comes from silence, is sustained in silence and resolves into silence. You know? The silence doesn't become noisy when you say om. If silence became noisy, you wouldn't be able to hear the om. In fact, there's a real key to this. That's why you probably, many of you, you know, have maybe done some chanting or chanting mantras, for instance. Say if you were to chant om. In the chanting of that mantra, or you chant something like Om Namah Shivaya, or use any type of chant that you do, one thing you start to realize is that all of your perceptions, all sounds, everything that you experience actually is taking place in silence. You don't usually think like this. You could say, another way you can say it is all of the experiences that you have are taking place, what if I say like this, all the experiences that I have are taking place in consciousness. In other words, everything that I know, it comes into consciousness, it is known, and it goes out of consciousness. Every single thought, like, and is consciousness noisy? That's the next thing. So when a sound comes into consciousness, it comes into this consciousness, which is actually silent. Consciousness is not making any noise. So every sound, every word, every perception is actually born, sustained, and drops away from conscious being. That's why it's known. Without consciousness, it can't be known. And the consciousness itself is silent. Okay? And so now, if you think like that, when this letter Om comes into being, right, what is supporting it is silence. When it goes out of being, what is still there is silence. But what is the nature of the silence here? In terms of your experience, what is the nature of the silence? Really, if I'm just saying om, silence, in terms of the actual sounds, then I'm talking about no noise, right? There's noise, there's sound, the absence of sound. Sound, the absence of sound. Sound, the absence of sound. It's true, right? Om, om, om. But now there's another level of silence. And this is the other level of silence. There's the om comes into my awareness. Awareness is silent. Om is known. It comes into your awareness. That om is known. The awareness is silence. Right? Om, the sound om, comes into silent awareness. The silence, so you have om, which is illumined by silent awareness, and then you have the silence between the two ohms. That silence is also illumined by silent awareness, because you're aware of the silence. And so you have om, silence, om, silence, om, silence. But the backdrop of the om, silence, is silent awareness, because you're aware of both the om and the end of the silence between the ohms. And so this is why when you're chanting a mantra, any mantra, but now we're working with om, as you continue chanting om, 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 by doing that, you're breaking all this associative thinking. Right? If you're saying one thing over and over again with a little silence in between, associative thinking will fall off, which kind of calms the mind down and lets it focus just on one type of thought. So say you're saying om, 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 om. The mind starts to relax, and what it starts to notice, or what comes very much to the forefront, is the silent being in which these thoughts, this omkara, this repetition of om, is taking place. When that's recognized, then we have the whole situation of om. This is the entirety of om, right? There's the a-u-m, waking, dream, and deep sleep, and the silence which contains it. The silence which contains the sound. If the a-u-m stands for the waking, dream, and deep sleep state, then when we look at the reality of all that exists in this creation, we have to think of waking, dream, deep sleep state, and the silent being in which these three states take place. Now we're not just talking about or ooh, We're talking about this waking state itself, the dream state itself, the deep sleep state itself, all of which enjoy the consciousness of my being. The consciousness of my being is what is represented by the silence of the omkara. And so, in terms of your experience, there's a discrimination that we call a viveka that can take place. And the viveka is kind of like this. It's very interesting when we think about it. It's so simple. In the waking state, you, the conscious person, are the waker, this body, mind, sense organs. So I will say, I, this me, this conscious being that I am the waker, existing, appreciating this dream state. But when you go into the deep sleep state, what you notice is that now I, the conscious being, the me that was the waker, is now the dreamer in the dream state. Right? Same me. The me who is the waker is now the dreamer. But what is so interesting here is that this self that I am, who was the waker, now doesn't have a waking world to experience or a waking subject. I'm not the waker. I've got a different body. I've got a different body and a different set of experiences in the dream state. In fact, the dreamer and the dream state negate the waker and the waking state in terms of what is actually being experienced. But the self, the me, that was the waker, is very much awake to the dream state. It's not two selves. But what I had totally taken myself to be as this physical body now is not me. Now this me has another body and another universe, a dream universe. And in the deep sleep state, there's no universe. And there's no subject-object relationship, but it is still me. I'm not annihilated in the deep sleep state. When I wake up and I am in the waking state and I have a mind, I'll tell you all about the dream state, which I couldn't do when I was in the deep sleep, which I couldn't do when I'm in the deep sleep state. Because everything's in kind of unmanifest condition, but I can describe it to you clearly. So as I start to analyze this, what I realize is actually the waker in the waking state is like a dress. And I change that dress to the dreamer in the dreamer in the dream state. And then I take off both dresses in the deep sleep state, and I'm just in kind of an unmanifest condition where there is no dress. There's no dress being experienced. There's no subject, there's no object. There is me. And so with this type of discrimination, it's just a tool for helping me to recognize the one who is present to contradictory states. It's a very important recognition that when we're doing the waking, dream, deep sleep, we're doing this recognition in terms of the totality of our experience. But you can also do it now in the waking state in terms of every moment of experience that you have. Like if I can say, I was sad yesterday. I was sad. And now I'm happy. There's a certain relationship here that needs to be understood. The me that was happy is now the same me. It's not somebody else. The me that was happy is now the me that was sad is now the me that is happy. If this is true, if I can be present and the self of both experiences, I'm neither one of them, right? If I'm the self of one experience and then I'm the self of a totally different experience, then I can't be either one of them. So I have to then try to recognize who is the one that is present to both, the happy state and the sad state or the agitated state, whatever the different states are. Who is the one that is present to both, to all? You know, who is the one? This is what old people tend to say this. I'm becoming old myself, so I can appreciate it. You know, when I so clearly remember my mother saying when she was in her late 70s, she said, "It's no fun to get old, honey. It's not fun to get old," she said. "I'm still the same person that I was when I was a little girl. I'm still the same person, but I'm in this old body. But it's still me. I'm still me." She's not the only one that has said that. A great philosopher, I think it was Bertrand Russell or somebody was talking like that. "I'm the same person, you know, but here I am in this old body." But when you go back in time, the little girl was you. The little boy was you. The teenager was you, you know. The person in their 20s was you. Yesterday was you. It was you. Even if you take it thought by thought by thought, I was the self of this thought, the self of this thought, the self of this thought. The thoughts are negating each other. They're gone. A thought comes, you experience it, it's gone. Every thought is like that. Every emotion is like that. The thought comes, you're aware of it, and it is gone. You're not gone. This gives me a space, this understanding, seeing this, it gives me a space. Okay, who's not gone? Who's not gone when the thought is gone? Who's not gone when one emotion is replaced by another? Because I'm the self of both. So what is said magnanimously in terms of the waking dream, deep sleep state, the waking world, the subtle world, the dream world, the unmanifest world? These are big, big, you know, covering big territory. It's the same whether you're looking at it in this huge territory of going from the waking world to the dream world to the deep sleep, or in small territory, thought by thought by thought, emotion by emotion by emotion, moment by moment by moment. The moments go, the experiences go, the emotions go, the identifications go, but you are always there. That's the kind of the Achilles heel. Sometimes my teacher is called the dream state really is the Achilles heel of that kind of gives you a, it gives it puts a little crack in what you think to be reality. Because the dream is so real, you know, when you're in it. If the dream can be so real when you're in it, where it's, you can imagine the dream character saying, of course this is real. Look at this. Of course this is real. This hurts. If I pinch my hand, this hurts. This has weight. You know? How can you say, you know? How can you say this is just some kind of a dream? What are you talking about? That's from the standpoint of somebody in the dream. If we're looking at this physical creation from the standpoint of somebody in this physical creation, how is the situation different, really, from the dream world? It is different, because the dream world comes out of my mind, right? So it's subjective. But it's not subjective for the person in it, the dream character in it. It's subjective from this standpoint, but from the person in the dream, the character in the dream, they're looking around in the dream with their five sense organs and their mind, and they're experiencing the dream as the reality. So here, I'm looking around here, and I'm experiencing this as the reality. Well, the problem is if this is the reality, what are the only reality, let's say, that I'm experiencing, then in fact, if that is true, then my being and who I am is very, very finite. Who you are is subject to death, is subject to change. If you're your mind, you're continually changing. If you're your body, you're subject to birth and death and old age. Birth, old age, death, disease, all of these types of things. Because that's what these things, that's what this body is. You know? So the duality and the experiences that we have in the world, if that is the, if this is it, if this is the reality, then there's nothing ongoing about me. Because there's nothing ongoing about this. Right? That's why this analysis has to be done, because nobody really believes on some level that the end of this life or the end of this world is the end of me. And I'll tell you why nobody really accepts it. You can be very brave and believe it. And not even believe it, you can just say, I don't know why all these people have any hope. Why do they have any hope? Because obviously, everything in the world perishes. And so, duh, you perish also. Right? So that's one position that you can take. But the problem is that on no matter what level of experience that we're talking, you cannot experience or even get close to the experience of non-existence. You can't have that experience. Even though everything that you experience comes into being and goes out of being. Everything. Everything in the world that you experience. And not only that, every moment of your experience is subject to birth and death, comes into being and goes out of being. It's just the way it is, and you accept it. Except for this. That's all happening to everything you experience. It's not happening to you. In other words, as you experience change, the one who is the self of that experience is not changing. Right? You experience the death of someone, or the drastic change of one experience moving into the next experience, which is a drastic change, that previous experience is not there. You do experience the death of the experience, right? All the time. So we experience change and death all the time for what we experience. But not for me. You always survive change. You understand what I mean? You always survive change. You always survive death. But you don't know. You know that you always survive the death in terms of the change that you experience, and in terms of the change that you experience in terms of your body or your thoughts or your emotions or other people. You're the constant. But because the identification with the body is so strong, your mind will say, yes, that's true what you're saying. Even the self of the little girl who's no longer here is the self of this adult. But what about when this body dies? Then all of my experience will go away. Then I'll experience non-existence when this body dies. Something like that, we say. You know? Even though, in fact, it doesn't make sense. It makes sense to us because this identification of the body is so total. But in terms of the totality of our experience, it makes no sense at all, because in our experience, every objectifiable experience, means everything that I know, everything that I can objectify, is born and dying all of the time. Every experience, and even in the waking, dream, and deep sleep state, I'm completely getting rid of one experience, totally gets rid of another. Even the identification with the body, you know. When the waking state is totally negated by the dream state, by the deep sleep state. That should make a dent in me. When I'm having a dream, and I am with a completely different body, completely different, subtle body. That's my experience. I'm with a different body than in the waking state. Shouldn't somebody get upset? Shouldn't somebody say, you know, this isn't my body. This isn't me. There's no problem at all. There's no problem at all. You know? You would think there would be, but there isn't. There's another thing we have to remember that I think is astounding. In the dream state, you can also not have a body. You can just be the whole dream. You don't have a body at all. Don't you think that should be a little strange or upsetting? But it isn't. It isn't at all. It isn't at all. It's as normal, as natural, as having a dream body, and as normal and as natural as having a waking state and a waking body. They're all absolutely fine. And then you might think that going to deep sleep would be a problem for you. Just that my teacher will go on and on about this because it really is kind of extraordinary. Realize what happens to you when you go to the deep sleep, when you go into the deep sleep. And first of all, probably all of us, including me, have a really nice bed with nice sheets and nice pillow. It's like an altar almost. It's nice sheets, nice pillow, nice comforters, you know, all made very nice and comfy. And then it's time to go to bed, and what do? Is I'll get into my bed, it gets so comfortable, you know, and just lay back and blot out everything that exists, the totality of my experience, happily blot out the totality of my experience, including this waking, the physical body, the mind, the sense organs, the memory. I don't even need a person saying, oh, now I'm deep sleeping. Isn't that wonderful? I'm deep sleeping. That person's gone. Mm. Now, I do this night after night after night, and I'll even take naps. This is an amazing phenomenon when we actually think of it. How much I enjoy, you know, just being with me. Just being with me. So going through, that's why this Mandukya Upanishad is really so powerful, because it's going through your daily experience of waking, dream, and deep sleep state, and looking at what's actually happening there for you. Because for you, in those three states of experience where so much is going on in each one of them except for the deep sleep, so much is going on at the same time that nothing is going on for you. You are there present, you're the self, you're the being, you're really the reality of all of those states. And all of those states, there's so much conflicting things going on, but not for you. One Achilles heel, when we look at this dream state, that can be shocking, and you can all try this if you haven't tried it already. Notice in the morning or in the middle of the night, whenever, when you wake up from your dream, if everybody dreams, when you wake up from your dream, notice what happens. I would almost say nothing happens. Nothing happens, even though the whole dream world has gone away. The entirety of the dream world that you were enjoying has gone away. But what has happened to you? Nothing. Really, what has happened to the dream world in terms of what is actually there? There's this uncanny sense that nothing has happened to that either. Basically, nothing has happened. Because nothing has happened to the very being which the dream world enjoys, you know? Now, to understand that, even to play with that idea, to really understand your the kind of the sanctity and the changelessness of your own presence, is to play around sometimes with your own imagination. Like if I ask you to imagine a meadow, a beautiful meadow, you know, with grass and animals and trees and the sun is shining and there's clouds, you're going to have this beautiful imagination of the meadow. And you can imagine yourself walking through the meadow. Right? This is like a miraculous thing, that I can imagine a meadow. I can enter the meadow, be walking around in the meadow. I can even let that scene develop on its own. Just set it going and it'll develop on its own. Now, in reality, I am the self of that whole thing. That imagination has me for its being. So when the imagination is there, I am there fully. I'm itself. When the imagination goes away, the same me is there. Nothing's happened to me, but the imagination has been withdrawn, right? Now say, I said, let me imagine the meadow again. And so out comes the meadow again. Now, still, I'm the self of the meadow, the being, the conscious being of every part of the meadow. And then I withdraw the meadow. And then, what am I? I'm the same conscious being now without the meadow. Do you think, have I lost something when I withdraw the meadow? This is something, actually, I'm saying it with kind of facetiously in a way, but it's something to actually be experienced. I imagine a meadow. First I am, then I imagine a meadow, and I enjoy the activity of the meadow, what's ever going on, and I withdraw the meadow. And have I lost something? Has something changed? And I would say, no, nothing has changed, because all the while, the only thing that is really there is the conscious being from which this imagination has come. So that's kind of a beautiful example that we can play with. But that example is really an example that, from the standpoint of the Mandukya Upanishad, is the nature of reality, in fact. In that your being, yourself, is the conscious being, you know, of this whole, of the whole experience. The experience comes from you, is sustained by you, and goes back into you. We have the dream example to try to understand what they're saying. We have imagination to try to understand what's being said here. Why I say like that is because what the Upanishads are saying is the reality of the whole creation. You get to experience on a subjective level. Because the Upanishads can say God, what is God, or what is the truth of reality, is the conscious being which is omniscient, you know, omniscient, all-pervasive, omnipotent, all of these words that are always applied to any type of understanding of God. When we say that, then we can imagine, and all different religions of the world will talk like this also, the creation comes from God. God is the creator. It comes from God, is sustained by God, resolves back into God. This type of talk is there. You have no clue what they mean. but if I use that type of language in terms of your imagination, You know, you are the Ishwara of your imagination. The imagination comes from you, is sustained by you, goes back to you. You're the self of the whole. You're the self of the whole. You're the self of the whole imagination, and when the imagination is withdrawn, you're simply the self, which is the truth of the whole thing, with or without the manifestation of the whole. So the whole Mandukya Upanishad is about this, and it wants you to have a name, Om, the name Om, the sacred syllable Om, so that when you say this word Om, if you understand it, it brings to your mind the nature of what is, of who you really are. Imagine if you are having a dream, you know, and you're a character in the dream, and you're looking around in the dream, and you have some friends there, and what's really going on? Who am I? Who am I? And what's the truth of all of this? I need to know who I really am. Now imagine the dream character saying that. How is that dream character going to find that out? Because all of the sense organs and the mind and everything, the hands, the legs, they're all part of the dream scenario. But this character has decided, I want to know who I really am. Is this me? Talking as a dream character, is this really me? Or is there something else? Is there something that lasts this, the finitude of this experience? Can anybody tell me? And so that character needs a dream guru. And that dream guru has to come and teach that dream character the truth of the whole thing. And what is the dream guru going to teach the dream student? It's interesting. Really, what does that student have to realize? It has to realize that, in fact, the self that you are is the self of the whole dream. The self that you are is the self of the whole dream. That going back to your imagination, or say if you think of a lucid dream, the whole dream comes from you. The whole dream equally enjoys you, the conscious being. The whole thing enjoys you, the one conscious being, and resolves into you, the one conscious being. So what does that mean? That the self that I am is the self that Ishwara is the self that you are, is the self that Tibby, my cat, is, the self that Ruby is, it's the self that all beings are. It's the self that the plant is, it's the self that the rug is. In a dream, right, the whole thing is enjoying only you. It's sustained by you and resolves into you. And so the Upanishad says like that, the whole creation, the waking state, and the waker is included in the waking state. The dream state. Dream state means not just this little your individual dream. What it means is by dream state, it means all dreams. The waking state means all the manifest creation that can be experienced by the sense perception. All the subtle realms by the dream state. The causal condition by the deep sleep state. All of this has you for its being. And the you that is the being of all of this is changeless. It is the what they call the A-U-M is one, the A-matra, the letter A, the U-matra, the letter U, the Ma, the Im-matra, the letter Im, A-U-M. And then that underlying silence is called A-matra. A-matra means there's no letter there. If there's no letter, if there's no name and form, what's to limit it? That amatra, and the om, right, the a-u-m, but the silence in which it takes place, there's no matra there. There's no limitation. This comes from silence, is sustained by silence, goes back into silence, but nothing happens to the silence. So the creation is viewed like that. This creation comes from me, is sustained by me, this me, the underlying being. The self of all beings, that conscious being which is me, which is the self of all beings. The creation comes from me, that self which is the self of all beings, is sustained by me and resolves back into me. I am its truth. And so that changeless truth, which is the very being that all things enjoy, I have to recognize. I have to be able to differentiate me. And I say me because it is me. When you say, you know, I was sad yesterday, but I'm happy now. I was a little girl, you know, 50 years ago. And that little girl is who I am now. Well, what part of you is who you are? What part of that little girl remains? The me, the self. That is the self. You know? And so that self is not going through any type of modification at all. So it's that me, that very personal me, that I need to differentiate. I don't have to have an experience of it. The experience of me is already here. I'm present to all my experience. But I have to differentiate me, myself, from all the things that I actually experience. All of those experiences come and go. If they come and go, it's not you. If it can happen, how can it be you? If an experience comes and goes, if it's gone and you're still here, it's not you. You can say, well, a thought comes, and when the thought is here, it's me. I say, okay. But what about when that thought goes, you're still here? Well, that's true. So what about you is the thought? What is it that the thought enjoys when it is here that is you? That is what needs to be discerned. Because the thought's not away from you, but when the thought goes away, nothing has happened to you. Just like when the imagination goes away, that imagination is you. It enjoys you, your being, your consciousness. The thought enjoys you, your being, your consciousness. But it doesn't go away. So that's a moment of discernment. So here, in as we're winding up the Mandukya Upanishad with just these very few verses left for this first chapter, what this verse is saying now is the pranava, this om, pranavaha, he indeed, this pranava is what we call aparam brahma. Aparam brahma, all that means is the Brahman which is manifest, the waking state, the dream state, the deep sleep state, the Saguna Brahman, the manifest universe. All that exists within time and space, pranava, om, is that. Pranava is the maya, the whole manifest creation. So aparam Brahman. Pranava is aparam Brahma, Brahman with the maya manifest, Ishwara. And pranava, pranavaha cha paraha smritaha. And pranava is clearly known smritaha. It's understood that pranava is param brahma also. Paraha. Paraha means that which is not limited by time or space or objectification, what is limitless. So when we say om, you have to count the silence from which the om comes. That's part of the pranava also. And that part is not contained, is not limited. So pranava is both aparam brahma, the manifest creation, and param brahma. Param brahma means the satchitananda, the conscious being, you know, which is changeless. It is that om is the truth of that om, the satyam mitya, the satyam is the param brahma, right? That which is remaining there in all three states. That brahman is apurva. Apurva means it has no prior condition. It's uncaused. It doesn't have a prior state, right? So it's uncaused. It's unborn. It's apurvaha. It's anantaraha. Anantaraha means for it, there is no second thing. That's one way of taking anantara. It has no second thing. It's abahyaha. It has no outside. It has no inside. It has no outside. This is no duality. It's anaparaha. It is not caused. It has no cause. It's not the cause of anything. And that pranava is avyayaha. It has no parts. Silence has no parts. So if you say a-u-m, the silence out of which the om rises and sets, that silence has no parts. Silence doesn't have a prior condition. Yeah. It can't be divided into parts. It doesn't have a prior condition, because we're talking about the silence in which the Om rises and sets. So the silence, the conscious being in which creation rises and sets, it has no beginning, it has no end, it's free from time and space, so that it has no parts. Time and space belong to the creation. You know? And so it's not something that can decay or fall apart. It's avyayaha. It's something which itself can't cause anything else. With what is it going to cause something else? Because it itself is changeless and has no parts. What's it going to do? It's beginningless, it's changeless, so nothing happens to consciousness. The conscious me that you are is the conscious being that you have always been and always will be. If you go back a billion years from the time, in terms of time and space that's going on with the creation, the very me that you are right now is the me that you were then, because there's no time. There's no time to consciousness. That's why we say sometimes, Puranaha, you're ancient but ever new. Ancient from the standpoint of the creation, but ever fresh, because from your own standpoint, you're timeless. So, let's stop there. I've only got a few more verses we'll do next week. Take a moment. Purnamidah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Harihi Om.
Sad for these dream characters that don't have knowledge available to them.
The only thing is, if you remember, we did a verse on Saturday that is subjective, right? So the dream is subjective, and it has a subjective order of reality. And so, when you wake up from the dream, you don't go back into it. So they just had a little temporary. Their existence was only temporary. It's not an ongoing, you know. They'd be okay. Because their being is always okay. The being of all beings is always okay. The self of all beings is always okay. It's always completely free. That's when they call, you know, in the East, all of the different darshanas and, the different ways of teaching and things that exist in India, all what we might consider a philosophy or something here is really not that at all. All of the philosophical understandings and philosophy and psychology are kind of merged together. But it all has the goal of freedom from suffering. That's what they call liberation or enlightenment, these rather big words. What they mean, though, is the eradication, the freedom from suffering. And no matter what the teaching methodology that's being used, they all agree that the eradication of suffering, the cessation of suffering, takes place through knowledge, only knowledge. Because otherwise the suffering would have to be something that is real. Right? Like say you actually are your physical body. Then whatever suffering that the physical body goes through is you're going through. There's no amount of knowledge is going to release you from that. But it's only if your being is by nature already free that you can become free. Depends on what you mean by free, you know. But yourself to say it's not the cessation of the temporary cessation of suffering. It's not what they're talking about. We have that here, you know. We get relief from suffering. We get pleasure and joy and nice situations and also very difficult ones in the world. You know, so you can eradicate suffering for a few moments here, a few moments, a few days, but you can't eradicate it completely unless that is your nature. Because if you were to eradicate it completely, that means that it has to be free from time. Because we're not talking about annihilation. Right? So if there is such a thing as freedom from suffering on the positive end, you know, that wholeness, completeness, all is well with me as I am-ness, you know, that has to be who you are. That has to be who you really are. And what causes you to take yourself otherwise is identifying actually with experiences that are coming and going. Not recognizing the freedom of your own nature. You know, if you recognize the freedom of your own being, these experiences of pleasure and pain, the experiences that the world has to offer, are a little bit different. The way you relate to them is quite a bit different. If you recognize the freedom of yourself in spite of those experiences. But if you have a total identification with all those experiences, then it's pretty harrowing, you know. Mm-hmm. What people say, and I think is kind of true, you know, if life is kind of like a, you know, the kind of a up and down like that. When you're up and everything is so wonderful, you become sad because you know that it's temporary. So you're on these big, beautiful moments. Bring the sadness of its finite nature of that beautiful experience. But when you're down in the dumps, then nobody's saying, oh, this is only temporary, don't worry. And that'd be nice if people thought that way, but they don't. It's, oh my God, is this it? Is this it? Is this how it's going to be? But then when you get up on the top again, oh, this is so wonderful, but I know it's only going to last for a minute. That's funny. But you know, your whole reality and experience of the world changes if you recognize your being that is present no matter what the experience. There's space then. There's space between yourself and the experiences that the world is throwing your way, so to speak. There's someone inside who is whole and complete, and fine as you are, who is then having to negotiate these experiences that take place in the world. That's totally different. Mm-hmm. You know, and then what you find also is once the mind recognizes this, wakes up to it, actually sees it, you have to see it. It's not just a nice intellectual thought. It's a recognition, but when you actually recognize that, then the mind settles down. It doesn't even have the same type of ups and downs anymore because it's not as threatened. You know, your well-being is not dependent on how well you're doing in the world, how much money you're making, or how nice people are to you, or you know, how your career is advancing, or how your family is doing, and on. I mean, it's on and on and on. So many variables. And to keep them all together in a way that's pleasing to you is very stressful. Very hard to do. You do it sometimes. Sometimes, but then you have to try to hold on to it. And it's hard. What if you don't have to do that? Because your own nature actually is fine. The being that you are is fine. It's whole and complete. And it's not dependent upon different types of thoughts or experiences. which it isn't and never has been, ever at any time. But the mind doesn't realize that. So that's why in all of the different teachings, you know, I mean, we're very involved in Vedanta, but it's not only Vedanta. All of these different teachings understand that the solution has to do with knowledge. Knowledge of what actually is. Because if you're behaving in the universe in a way that is the opposite to how it is, then things aren't working out very well. It doesn't work. If you take yourself to be actually something that you're not, then that also doesn't work. It's hard. Nothing falls into place.
In the word apurvaha, is pura the root?
Purva. Purva means that which is prior, before. Mm-hmm. Apurva means there is no before. There's no prior condition. So the one who is apurvaha means it has no cause, because mm-hmm. there's no prior condition. Mm-hmm. And no, I don't think the root is pur.
So it's not related to
purna. It's not related. The root of purna is pr, with a long r. It becomes ur, purna. Mm-hmm. Past passive participle, actually, with an unusual formation, but purva doesn't come from that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what its etymology is, actually, for that particular root.
Is it possible to notice the silence while a lot of noise is going on?
Yeah. It's a wonderful meditation. Maybe you got a chance to do that when you were listening to the Beatles. There's these guys that for the last several long time now, it seems like, they're almost every evening they're playing these Beatles songs, so we got to enjoy some. But you know, the thing is, it's actually, that's really an interesting, beautiful meditation to see the truth of it, that sound, all sound is taking place in silence. And you can kind of appreciate, like, if it weren't, you wouldn't be able to hear it, right? So the sound itself takes place in silence. So you can let yourself, it's really the silence of consciousness. Because in the world, there's the opposite sound, silence, sound, silence. Sound displaces the silence, right, in the world. But actually, in terms of your experience, both sound and silence take place in the silence of your being, in the silence of consciousness. And so if you appreciate that, it allows you to differentiate, it allows your mind to differentiate your being, the silence of your being, from all of the sounds that are taking place. Then you can do that same differentiation in reference to thoughts. All thoughts themselves are taking place in the silence of your own presence. And you can see, okay, this thought comes and goes, this thought comes and goes, but I remain untouched the same. So these are, there's almost like mental gymnastics in a way, ways to help you really see what's going on in there. You know, who you actually are. Because we don't think about it. We don't have to think about it because we're busy. We're busy with everything. Life is busy. We have so many things to do. You know, we don't necessarily have the space or the time or the desire or inclination to stop everything and say, what's really going on here? Who am I? Who is this person that's involved in all of this? No. Most people aren't interested. No. They're too busy. It's considered a great, great blessing, actually. A great punya, they say, you know, great, great, great gift, great blessing to have a mind who asks these questions. You know? The question need not arise. Really need not arise. Even the question of who am I need not arise because it's always being answered. You know, like say if you're a mother, you say, well, who am I? Well, I'm a mother trying to take care of my family. You know? And then when you're at work, you can say, like my mom would say, Well, honey, I'm a secretary to your father. I'm taking care of his office. You're a sister, you know, you're a sister to your sister or brother. You're a teacher to your students. You're a student to your teacher. So who you are is continually...
It's defined for you.
All the time, in many different roles. Then say you were to ask, well, yeah, but who is that person who's a mother to her daughter and a sister to her brother and a teacher to her student and a student to her teacher? You know, who's the person that's playing all these roles? Because you're only that in reference to the role, but who are you, the one who's taking on all those roles? And if you start thinking like that, you know, it's kind of a slippery slope. But fortunately, there are some... The Upanishads are so beautiful. You can imagine they come from a different culture. They're thousands and thousands and thousands of years old, and even from their own standpoint, they're timeless. They come with the creation. It's part of a cyclical creation. They're so ancient, and yet they're so relevant that these can even be taught today. The same Upanishads in the same ancient language, you know, with the same commentaries that are still so relevant to, they're relevant to human beings, and we're still human beings. So.
Yeah, they're still interesting.
Well, they still do the trick. They do the job. They are quite interesting. Yeah. But they say for a person who, for whom these questions are important, you know, and they're not important to everybody at a given time. They're important, but to the person to whom these questions, these who am I type questions, what is the nature of reality, who am I, what happens to me when I die, all these kind of questions. For those kind of people, the Upanishads are said to be, just to, in terms of importance, just how would it be for you if you... If your hair was on fire, how would you go toward the lake? Say you were having a bonfire near a lake, and one of the flame, you know, one of the sparks. Ember sparks caught your hair on fire, if you can imagine. They talk about, the, in the India, you know, these sadhus will have their hair would be called jada. It would be, it's all matted. Hair is matted, and it's so long, and they take this long matted hair, and they wrap it around their head. They're wearing this big kind of hair piece. On the, so imagine a spark landing on that. You know, how you would go toward the lake. You know, you wouldn't saunter. And that is how an Upanishad, when these Upanishads are being taught, that's how a person who has these questions takes to that, takes to those Upanishads, because they're answering in a very kind of logical way that is actually dissecting in a way the actuality of your experience so that you can actually see. So as you hear an Upanishad being taught, a lot of people have, they all, the people describe their experience in different ways, but one way that is I've commonly heard, and it's been also true for me, it's like finally what you've always known, but there's never been any words and nobody has ever said it. But it's as though you're finally hearing what you've always known. But you had never been able to make that manifest in some way. And so it's like a huge relief, because it's holding up a mirror to who you actually are. And so you recognize it very deeply. It's very comfortable. It's a comfortable fit. You know? And you always knew it, but you could never say it because you didn't know it. Mm-hmm. You knew it without knowing it somehow. Yeah.
Well, it's like connecting the dots.
Connecting the dots. And connecting the dots in a way that includes you. Yeah. Usually when we're connecting dots of everything that we perceive, but the subject, the me, is left out. Because even the mind is not really the subject, because the mind itself is known and experienced. Your body is known and experienced. Your sense organs are known and experienced. So what about you? Yeah, the one who's there. That's why when you're meditating or just doing a deep relaxation like what we did tonight, deeply, deeply relax so that the body isn't clinging or creating a lot of sensory noise, so to speak. And your mind also, it's fine for it just to be whatever it's doing, so that you can just let it be, let it relax. It kind of gives you some space to just to see, who are you? Who's the one that is just simply being here? You know, without, when getting rid of all of the extraneous distractions, so to speak, you just relax them away, deeply relax them away. And just notice your own presence. It's not about looking anywhere, it's just who's there. It's very simple in that way. We make it much more complex. As though there's some big capitalist self that we have to have a magical experience of, when actually, that isn't what it is. That's not what the Upanishads are talking about.
The word presence for me is even more resonant than being.
Mm-hmm.
Being, that there's something about that word that...
You know what, the word being sometimes doesn't evoke consciousness.
Mm.
Presence does.
Mm.
Your presence evokes, the being is implicit in it,
mm-hmm.
and also consciousness is. So presence also works for me. Yeah. Another thing that works for me, though I'm not sure it works for everybody, but it does work for me, is using the word me.
Mm-hmm.
Me is a very personal word. When you say me, it's landing on me, the sense of me. You know? For some words, you would think I, the word I, would work that way also, but it doesn't work as well as the word me. You know?
In the Sanskrit language, they have me, like that singular person.
So don't use
pronoun,
it.
Aham. So in that sense, that aham is...
But aham,
me, but in English it doesn't land in the same way.
It doesn't. Of course, the I, me, that would be aham and mom, but we don't use...
Yeah.
But you're right, that the word aham, because of the teaching itself, even though it means I, lands more. But nothing lands as well as the word me for me.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason. You know? But maybe that's just so personal. And what is it that makes me me?
Yeah.
And you can... differentiate that, whatever that word is indicating, from all the experiences that you're having. Even when you meditate, you know, and you're just kind of relaxing all other experiences away, what is left is me. I'm always the one left. So what is that one like? Right? I'm the one in meditation. As you withdraw from sensory experience, best way to do that is to deeply relax. Then who is left? It's always only me, not somebody else. Then I am left. So who is that? What am I? Then you can ask yourself, what am I like? What is this one who's left like? What am I like, this person here?
Yeah, well, when you do that, I feel like me is left, not aham.
I know. That's what I'm saying. The me.
Yeah.
Right?
Like the aham gets into the aham.
Can.
Yeah, it has that sense for me, like I do this,
yeah.
I am this, you know, I am.
Yeah, you know, even when you're talking about meditation, and you say, who is left there? Well, the one who's left is me. You say, for me also, if I say I am left there, then somehow I become, is too associated with the doer. Or the thinker, or the seer, because I is always the subject of a sentence, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some identity.
But me is not the subject of a sentence. And so it's freed of that doership, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have such a bad rap.
Yeah. Yeah.
Me doesn't have such a bad
rap. It doesn't. And the subject is removed when you say me, because me can never be the subject of a sentence. So that takes care of all of the doership and enjoyership is taken away when you take away the I, and when you have the me. Me is a completed state. Yeah.
Did you think that out, or did you stumble across that, or what? How?
I didn't think it out. It was just was a fact. I'm thinking it out as I'm talking.
When
I talk about it, then I think it out. But that. I didn't need to think it out for the it to work like that for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Certain words work better for different people also.
Yeah. Yeah.
Carol, how come this verse talks, could you say, what's the inferior, prominent?
Well, it's really, it's not, upada is better than inferior, right? Pada means that which is, or param brahma, means that which is the same as parama, means that which is not limited by time, space, or quality. So its nature is infinite. Non-dual infinite being is param brahma. When we say aparam brahman, we're talking about brahman with the manifestation of maya. That same conscious being, which is the truth of your dream. But if I'm talking about param brahma, I'm only talking about the conscious being, which is the truth of the whole thing. If I'm talking about aparam brahma, I'm talking about also the whole manifest creation. So you could say Ishwara means the conscious being with maya, with that which projects the entire creation, that what we call mitya, or that dependent reality. That's what we call apara. So Brahman with the creation is apara Brahman. Brahman without the creation, just the conscious being, which is the truth of it, is param brahma. If you use the example of the, I'll use two examples. Say if we have our clay pot, the clay pot. Param brahma is the clay. Aparam brahma is the pot, apara brahma. Because the pot is nothing but clay, right? There's only clay there. So param brahma is the clay. It's the non-dual clay. What is actually there is clay. But then there's the pot. Okay, that's aparam brahma. Because really the pot isn't there. It's maya. Okay? So in this creation, what is really here is the non-dual conscious being. That's param brahma. But when we take it, this creation, this manifestation really has no separate being at all from Brahman, just like the pot has no separate being, no existence whatsoever, independent of Brahman, independent of clay. There's really only clay there. So the aparam brahma is acknowledging the whole maya creation.
Mm-hmm. The mitya.
The mitya. Well, the mitya is the order of reality. You would say, if we look at the clay pot, the clay is what we call satyam. It is real. What is actually there, satyam. The pot is mitya, means it has no being of its own. Right? Pot has no being apart from the clay. Okay, I'll see you later. So the pot has no being apart from the clay. So that's what we call mitya, a Sanskrit term for that. So the whole creation has no being apart from Brahman, so it's aparam brahma. Right? They say inferior Brahman because they don't have any words. We don't have good words to.
So it's not really that one is superior and one's inferior. That's just.
There's no. If everything is Brahman, where's inferior or superior? One is just acknowledging the creation. From the standpoint of the creation, there's time and space and all duality. But what is actually there is only Brahman. So it's just used to distinguish. Aparam Brahman, that Aparam Brahman is bound by time and space and all of these things, you can say. Whereas what is actually there is Param Brahman.
So this is kind of a poor translation, using those words?
I think that when you're talking about using the Sanskrit and the whole vision that's held in the Vedanta, it's good to keep the Sanskrit words and then spend paragraphs defining what they are. You know, so that you don't always have to come up with a synonym. Because the problem with synonyms in English synonyms, is that there aren't really any English synonyms. But they're all loaded with English meanings. So for instance, say the jiva is sometimes translated, the jiva is the subtle body that transmigrates, taking birth after birth after birth, right? taking physical body after physical after physical body. That's called the jiva. Sometimes it's translated as soul. Now, what does soul mean? Soul has its own meaning depending on what religion is using it, right? So if you translate jiva as soul, now all of a sudden the jiva becomes contaminated by the specific meanings that you have in your mind about the definition of soul. And so that's why it's much easier to build up a Vedanta vocabulary where each word is defined and discussed. And so it becomes, in a way, like just another English word. It's just, you know what this word means so well that you can use the word. Right? Once you know a word means, then you can use that word. And so we try to make these words understood for what they really mean and not try to have a synonym. And that's also why this Mandukya Upanishad is so such a beautiful Upanishad, because they're actually giving you a word. It's called the most sacred syllable, the pranava, this om. They're actually unpacking it, you know, so the word is actually containing the totality of the knowledge the Upanishads have to give once it's understood, you know. And so that's what the Mandukya Upanishad does, is it fills these three syllables with meaning. So then say a sannyasi or somebody who's, you know, committed to this particular tradition can say this sacred syllable and it brings the whole vision to your mind. You know? Otherwise it's a beautiful sound anyway. You know?
But this is the definition of what om.
Mm-hmm. And it's even more than a definition, because it's a whole, can you imagine reading the definition in a dictionary that's maybe 10 pages long or something, just defining this one little, it is a definition.
I've never done that.
So it's really a teaching to bring the meaning of this word to life, so that when you say it, it actually brings to your mind the whole teaching. How are we doing? You done for the night?
Yeah. Are we going to finish? It sounded like you said we're going to finish the Prakarana next week. Right?
Yeah.
And then we're going on to the Anna.
Vaitatya. I think so. I'm going to read through it. I looked through it, and I think we should at least do that one more chapter.
Yeah.
One more. At least, and then we'll decide after we finish that chapter if we want to do one more.
Yeah. I like the third.
Like the third, the Vaitatya really goes through the mitya, and then the next one. Vaitatya means mitya, the order of reality that this whole creation enjoys. And then the third one is called the Advaita Prakarana, and that just deals with the non-dual nature of all that is. It'd be good.
Yeah, let's keep going with it. Then we get kind of more.
Why not? for both of you, one thing to understand about this Upanishad, this is the last Upanishad that's ever taught, you know. So most of these people have had a lot of experience.
And
now this is the final Upanishad that we teach, even though people...
We're the beginners in the advanced class.
kind of a little bit.
Yeah, you're studying in reverse.
But, you know, when I first went to India, the first text that I heard my teacher was teaching was the Brahma Sutras, which is after all the Upanishads are taught, and all of what they call the Prakarana Granthas, the explanatory text of all the Upanishads, then and only then do you teach the Brahma Sutras. And that's what I came into. And it was like 90% Sanskrit, and I was totally, you know, I sat there for every class and got every little morsel that I possibly could. But there was a lot of us and ands and does that I would recognize. I wanted to know it so badly. You know, that was...
I was drinking chai at the chai shop in the system.
Your hair was on fire.
My hair was on fire. It was. Yeah. It's wonderful. Those were the days. Amazing time.
Did you get much of it at that time?
Well, you know what? Whatever there was to get, I got.
Yeah.
But for me. But right. It was like 90% Sanskrit. But there would be times when he would explain in English, you know, and there would be a lot, during that period, also a lot of satsang. Satsang means where you're sitting like this, with having question, answer, and discussing. There was a lot of that, too, you know. And sometimes he would give more English than at other times, not pretty much, but it was kind of like throwing out little gifts to the handful of English and speaking students that were there. But it worked its way around. You know, after that was done, then we started another course and started from the very beginning and all that. And going around for a while, for 6 months, before we started a 3-year course where you had a chance to just sit and study from the beginning, he would go from town to town on what's called giving yagnas, which would be usually 10-day talks or 2-week talks, where people would come every morning and every evening, early morning, like at 6 in the morning, have a meditation in class, and then they'd go to work. And then after work they'd come and there would be another class in the evening. But for those of us, some group of his students who were traveling with him, which I also got to do, he would give classes for us while everybody else was at work. You know, we'd have a class in one class in the morning and one class in the late afternoon. And then there'd be an evening class. So that's how for months, just a group of us, mostly Indians, brahmacharis, were traveling around from town to town taking trains. And we'd get to the town where he was, and then the devotees and students in that town would take all of us in and make space for us, and then we'd go to the talks. And that went on and on.
Wow, what a great life.
What a life, yeah.
Yeah.
I was young enough to be able to manage. That was good. You're going on the 3rd?
Yeah.
What day is the 3rd? That's Friday.
Right.
I didn't send you my list.
You didn't send me your list, but I got Edward's list.
But Edward just told you the list, right?
Yeah.
That's not good enough.
That's good enough for me.
No. You know, when I look at my list now, I feel like that list is a little bit...
dated.
Yeah. It's a little bit dated.
No iPads or iPhones.
Yeah, there was no... None of that.
Yeah, there wasn't any of that.
Now
that's
there is.
True.
You can't escape the internet.
This is the what to take with you.
Yeah.
Does it have computer on it?
I don't think
it
does.
I think it was in the 70s, was it?
Here's what it's called, Stuff
it
for
that
India.
Long
that must be that. India list. Here's what I wanted. India list.
You can go over and study the list and check it out.
Okay, but some of it, you won't think of it like knife and spoon.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't have thought of
no, yeah.
And clothespins.
Travel mug, strong umbrella, socks for warding off mosquitoes, mosquito repellent that you can tolerate.
Clothes hangers.
Maybe a mosquito net. Both warm and lightweight shawls. Travel alarm clock. Batteries. Asana. Asana means like something to sit on, you know,
well,
if you have it.
She's got a socks.
Oh, yeah. Book bag, notebooks and paper, clothesline and clothespins. Very important.
Really?
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to send you this. Flash drive.
Oh.
Yeah.
Flash
some
drive. Can't be that old.
Aloe vera, Purell hand sanitizer. You thought of all that
no.
kind of stuff? See? This list has been passed around and added to. So
the wisdom gets
Even a little battery lamp. Do you have a little battery lamp?
No.
You need a little battery lamp. You need a little battery lamp.
Mario's shopping now. There she goes.
I might have
well,
one. I wonder if I still
past.
Have one to loan you. You know what? I'll tell you.
I have one.
No, but you're blowing it off. I just listen to me. The lighting
yeah.
Electricity is not constant. You know, and so say in India, you get up early, like, I don't know, 4:30 or 5. You just get up around 5. And the lights won't necessarily be on. Or you'll be in the shower, and the lights will go off.
I remember the heat. Even when the lights were on, the heat from the light bulb was so hot that I couldn't stand it.
Yeah.
That's what I remember.
So still, you know, the electrical currents are not... We do have a battery generator backup.
Actually, it's pretty good.
It's pretty good. Yeah. But that happens frequently. And so you don't want that to happen when it's dark. And also, say if you like to read, it's nice to have one of these small lights.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm going to send you this.
Barnes & Noble, $10.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll have a few days. So.
Oh, I do have laptop. Yeah, down here. Water bottle, safety pins, needle and thread. Okay.
This is great.
Yeah.
Wow.
is it as bad worrying about theft as people say?
Yeah.
I've heard it's really bad on the trains.
You have to be really careful.
First time I went to India, I just showed up. You know?
What's your email?
RCLYNLEY.
Okay, RCLYN.
Uh-huh. LEY.
Uh-huh.
At Gina.
I have it, but it's on my other, my Mac. This is on the Windows. RCLYNLEY at Gmail. Hmm?
Yeah.
Okay. India list. We have sent this thing around for so many times.
I want to see what you think of to add to it.
Yeah, then you add to it and you send it back.
It's like a chain letter.
A chain letter, yeah.
Is there flip flops on there?
Should be.
Oh, you already know.
That's important.
I'm reminded about the flip-flops.
Non-leather, no leather.
Is that number one on your list?
Don't forget your flip flops.
Having also, it'll be hot there, but having a lightweight shawl, you'll need that. Okay. Should be lightweight, especially just because of the mosquitoes when you're sitting up at temple and that type of thing. You need that. Yeah. You have a great time.
Thank you.
Yeah. The Singapore Airlines is a nice airline.
How did she pick that? How
he
did
told
you,
you
the
right?
Perfect one.
I don't know. I picked it.
You picked the perfect
really?
One.
Really?
Naturally.
Well,
right up.
It's the right one. It's a really, really good airline. It's one of the best airlines. And there's more room. There's more leg room. They have all kinds of movies and audio that you can watch. You have your own little thing. You know, like usually they save that for first class, but they have it. So you just keep entertained for the 23-hour ride. And also, I would suggest ordering the, you know, you have to order your meal. You should call right away if you haven't done that. I like the vegetarian Indian. It's actually really, really good.
Okay.
Yeah. So you have to do that. Otherwise, you might get stuck with one of the others that you don't like. See.
I made the mistake of staying up all night with one of those movie things when I went to Tibet.
Yeah.
And I paid a heavy price. I would rarely get some sleep on the plane. Big time change.
Yeah, there is. You know, another thing I do, there's a 9-hour layover in Singapore. I rent there's little hotel rooms in the airport. Mm-hmm. You know that?
I heard that. Yeah,
yeah. You can rent a room. Mm-hmm. And you'll want to, you can take a shower and sleep.
It must be nice.
It's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
good.
Break.
You really want that. And also, you can lock your stuff in the room. And the Singapore airport is like this gigantic mall. Everything is, it's a huge, huge, very fancy airport with everything imaginable in it. You know, of every, it can go, so much wealth is there, let's put it that way. It's a manifestation of wealth. You know.
The opposite of the ashram.
The ashram is simple.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, Singapore is good. And do you have somebody coming to pick you up? Do they know that you?
I'm talking to them right now, trying to arrange it. Hopefully.
Just, you know, what you do, this is just the etiquette, is you ask for somebody to come and pick you up,
mm-hmm.
and but they will. And then later, like the next day, you go and you give some rupees for them having done that.
Mm-hmm.
I usually give about 1,000 rupees, which is less than $10.
Yeah.
You know, and then because they don't have a lot of money, so we always try to, you know. And then when you leave, then you leave a donation because they also don't charge. You know?
Yeah.
So that's how you do it. And it's really beautiful. And then they, Ramu and the guy, there's one guy who works in the office, he'll run around and get things for you if you need things. So you need something from town, they'll take you to town if you want to go, or you'll give him a list of what you need and he'll get them for you. It's all very, very wonderful people. Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a bookstore there too, don't forget.
A good bookstore.
Should I bring you back something?
No, okay. And then that bookstore is downstairs, and upstairs is sort of a presentation of Swamiji's life, a bunch of photographs.
Oh, really?
Don't miss out on those. Okay, yeah. That's a good thing to see.
Some devotees put that together.
Yeah.
We're in it.
Really?
Yeah. You can see her. You can see Radha younger than you.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so funny. Sitting at one of these little desks on the floor, they have these little type of floor collapsible desks, and there I am in my little place with a bunch of the other students, you know, listening to the teaching.
Yeah.
I must have been about 23. Yeah. It's funny to see that.
Yeah.
How old were you when you first went there?
23. My niece Kristen, when she went, she was I find this so interesting. She was also 23. She was the same age, and I ended up taking her. It was unplanned, actually. One thing led to another, and I ended up taking her to India with me. And she landed in India at the same age that I did, which was quite an interesting experience to me to realize how young I was.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, what it means to be 23.
Okay.
You know. She's older now, she's 27 now, but with 23, you know, you're young, very young. So, well, that's when I was in India, when I was 23 to about 30, three more, and then going back and forth.
Mm. Well, pretty soon 65 is going to be young.
Yeah, it's just our bodies getting old. Did you start teaching when you came in 30?
I was teaching almost right away, and the reason for that, it was not that I planned to come back and really be a teacher, but when I went to India, there's a lot of people who didn't go, who couldn't go for one reason or another. You know, most of those people were students of Swami Chinmayananda. And they couldn't have, because of life, age, so many things, they couldn't run off to India. And so when I came back, then there was somebody there who had been studying for quite a long time. And so I started just taking classes with them. I'd taken some classes in India also. It happened kind of naturally. It's lucky for me. Teaching is the best way to learn. It really is, you know, because it's active. Listening is passive in a way, you know, but giving it back out is active. So that's, and I think that they say, you know, teaching, writing, these type of things are really one of the greatest, what they call sadhanas, for really owning up the knowledge. So. Okay, we are done.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol.
Sure. Yeah. So, Rosa, will I see you again? Okay.
Thank right. you so much for all your help.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's a
so much advice and guidance.
She should have been here yesterday.
So you're a goner now?
Yeah.
Yes, she
was
good.
It was so
funny. Well, y'all have a great time. Yeah, it's really wonderful.
Yeah.
So are you, which one of you is her mom? And
I am.
That's what I thought. And then you're...
I'm a good friend.
A good friend. Right?
Of moms.
Of moms.
And becoming a great admirer of Rosa.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm, there's this, whoever she is in me is... going with her to India, I can feel it.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
Just by curiously, I can really... Yeah.
Well, maybe you'll end up going someday.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
Well, what's really unique for Rosa, though, she's falling into the best of the best.
Oh.
It couldn't be any better. So I just...
Yeah, traditionally, that's true. It's a highly honored and esteemed
tradition. She's been... birthed from the best here. Why would she not be going? Where the best is waiting for her.
Yeah, birthed in many ways.
Guide you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Lovely. Good to meet you, Carol.
Yeah.
Thank
you
so much.
Pleasure.
Mine too.
Yeah. Come anytime, please.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bathroom's calling me.
Yeah, I understand.
Can I take this from you?
Yes.